It could be. What if kids want to know about barrel bombs?
What's worse, a barrel bomb or a swear word? Hello and welcome to another episode of the Trachtenberg Wonkcast. I'm your host, Nathan Rupp. On this week's roundtable, we will be joined by our regular contributors and a special guest. Let's introduce the crew now. To my left.
So my name is Albert Anaim. I am a Masters of Art in Public Policy student focusing on philosophy and social policy.
I'm Haley Dunn. I'm a Masters in Public Policy candidate focusing on social policy.
Name is Adam Brooks. I am a master's in public policy focusing on defense policy.
So let's start with our first feature, Below the Fold, where we talk about policy issues that may have been overlooked due to the bold headlines.
I got one. Sean Spicer, that guy. He doesn't deserve to have his name, you know, said correctly, because this guy is an idiot.
Go on.
He will be the first press secretary in American history to start a war with another country. He said that barrel bombs were a red line. Using, as if Assad used barrel bombs on the civilian population, it would be a red line for the Trump administration, which is ridiculous because all the Assad regime uses now is barrel bombs.
Could you explain what that is?
A barrel bomb is a very cheap like bomb. It only costs like $200 to $300 to make because it's basically a barrel with improvised explosive devices, incendiary devices, and chemical agents inside of it. So you basically kick it off the back of an aircraft or a helicopter and you light it on fire before it drops. And you drop it in a refugee camp, or you drop it in a population center, and you create mass casualties. It's devastating. Mm-hmm. That's why they're illegal to use.
So it's like a Molotov cocktail, but huge scale.
But the military grade.
Yeah, military grade Molotov.
Wow. Best way to describe it is a flying IED. It's a flying IED.
And so why is Sean Spicer saying this such a big deal then?
Because if that's the red line, you're basically saying the Syrian Air Force either stops operating entirely because all they have is barrel bombs. They don't have anything else. They don't have enough money to buy conventional weapons. Or we're going to go to war. We're going to keep bombing them every time they use barrel bombs, which is essentially, it's a sustained air campaign. So either the Trump administration has to push away from Spicer and say, hey, he doesn't speak for us, which means they have to fire him, or they roll with it, mm-hmm. because this is a red line, and they've gotten, you know, on Obama's case about not, you know, reinforcing his red line, and so they either embrace
it. Does this delineate a clear mark or change in American foreign policy towards Syria, or is this just potentially an off-the-cuff statement, or does this actually potentially show something greater?
Yeah, it is a big change because they've been using barrel bombs for 5 years. And if we say we're going to respond every time you use a barrel bomb, we're saying we're going to go to war. Even attacking after they use the chemical weapon is a change in American policy. And Spicer is not the first one from the administration to come out and say something like this. Nikki Haley was on, I believe it was Fox News, and she said that regime change was on the agenda. She implied heavily that regime change is something that we're pushing for now. That's my update.
Nice. Haley?
I was going to mention Trump recently today in his favorite medium of
that
Twitter.
Is recent.
Yes. he had tweeted at China that if they wanted more favorable trade policies, that they had to step up in their pushback on North Korea. And one thing that has been in the news, but Syria has kind of overshadowed a bit, is that we sent a Navy carrier strike group to the waters off the Korean Peninsula as a show of force, which we've done before.
The Sea of Japan, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. But it's a much harder situation in terms of North Korea having much more of a capability to fight back than Syria does at the moment, especially considering the proximity of South Korea and major population centers. So I think that that's going to be something that's interesting, and I think Trump is trying to use what he's slightly more familiar with in terms of business and trade to try to leverage more political support from China. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
You can tell how serious this is because the Chinese just deployed 150,000 troops on the North Korean border. And these aren't just any troops. These are like the best they have. This is like the 39th and 40th Army Group. These are like crack Chinese infantry units. Because they believe that this might destabilize North Korea and that refugees might come flowing over the border. So they're
not there to help out. They're there to
contain
the refugee
they
population.
They are there to contain it, yes.
So Albert?
Yeah, so I want to pivot, I guess, to more domestic policy things. I mean, all over the news has been things about United Airlines and specifically their, I don't know, assault and ejection of one of their passengers who was also a medical doctor. But what I thought was interesting is the handling of the case, or perhaps the mishandling of the incident, turned me to the U.S. deregulating the airlines back in 1978, and it's one of the first industries that that the government willingly stepped back from and just said, you know, it was completely ineffective and inefficient for us to continue regulating them. And, you know, I wonder if this lack of regulation sort of led to, you know, at least partially led to this sort of terrible thing that happened, you know, the overselling of so many seats that they had to drag out 8 people.
So bigger picture, is this, do a lot of incidents like this happen? I mean, do you feel like
apparently a lot more, I mean, there's been, I've read a couple op-eds today, you know, about people who were also thrown off planes. Several of them actually sued in retaliation and won, which I thought was super interesting.
I've been asked to get off the plane with an incentive of like, we'll give you so many miles and a free hotel. But
yeah,
never,
that's
very
and that's
common.
How that's how
yeah,
this,
I've never,
well, that's how this
seen
began. They oversold and they asked 8 people to get off because they had 8 basically higher status flight members who were on board who had paid more, so they wanted to give them the seats. No one took the offer, so then they said, okay, we're going to do a random draw of 8 people to get off, and one of them happened to be this doctor who said, I can't get off, I refuse to get off, and then they said, well, no, you're going to get off, we're going to send this officer over here to make you get off.
I think it was to free up room for United crew members to get to...
Oh, was that...
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, what it was, so the complaint was, you're right, so I misspoke. The complaint was that of the random draw, it was no one in first class, no one in, you know, the premium,
right,
coach class, whatever it's called, business class, and it was no one who was like a frequent flyer above, like the gold level. So it was basically, you could argue, classism in effect, that they were just targeting the poorest of the poor who all bought coach, and they were the sample that we're drawn from.
I mean, those are the important people, man. You can't kick them off the plane.
Well, exactly. That's the market dictating, which made me think about the fact that we deregulated this industry, and you know, these are perhaps, I don't know. I mean, Nathan, what do you think? I know you're a regulatory guy.
So I don't know too much about the airline regulations and deregulations. I know that for a long time, the biggest issue was that it was subsidized where they would go, so that was the regulation. It wasn't so much what you could do as much as you were forced to fly certain routes, and they would subsidize routes so that you would basically require airlines to go to certain places despite whether or not there was a demand for it or not. And so by deregulating, what they ended up doing is creating this new spoke and hub system, which they have now, which is how you see cities like Atlanta and Chicago, Philadelphia, and New York, and LA, and probably, I think, Dallas, Fort Worth, ever, whatever, Love Field, whatever it is.
Yeah.
They become these central hubs where airlines will fly to and you'll connect from, opposed to having these unnecessary direct flights, which people may want, but they may not want. Instead, you'll have these hubs throughout the country, which kind of creates this spoken hub system they have now, which is a result of the deregulation, which actually makes it a much more efficient system. But again, I think there are, overselling it and those types of things. I don't know about that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it actually segues nicely
up, yeah.
to my bury the lead. It is that the administration has named the new, or is proposed head for the Office of Information Regulatory Affairs, the regulatory czar, as some people call him. It is Naomi, I don't know how to say his last name, R-A-O?
Rao?
Rao? Naomi Rao.
This will be your boss potentially.
Yeah, she'll be my boss potentially in the summer. Yeah. And basically, this really solidifies the Trump agenda of deregulation. She is really has a proven track record of being a market solutionist and someone who does not believe in government intervention. So that's my buried headline, buried the lead, whatever it's called. We'll get there.
We'll figure it out.
We'll get there. And we're going to take a break. We're back. This is a section without a title yet. This is where our guest host will be highlighting particular research or interest that they are kind of brought here to discuss.
All right, so I guess that's me. So as a part of my curriculum, let me start with my program is interdisciplinary. It's philosophy and social policy, and it's half my coursework is done in the Columbian School with the philosophy department. And the other half is done in the Trachtenberg School with the public policy department. And the design of the program, or the program is designed rather, to look at policy through this these philosophical lenses. And the lens I focus on particularly is the lens that is social justice and, you know, how we might think we is a fair way to distribute the benefits and the burdens of living in a society of government and of, you know, different institutions. So that being said, my master's program, or my thesis, I'm sorry, as a part of the master's, is focusing on inner-city African-American men, inner-city black men, as I call them, or ICBMs. that was just purely coincidental. Inner-city black men and the injustice of the situation that they've been put in. In particular, their exclusion from poverty alleviation measures, you know, welfare. And basically, welfare has several means tests, and these means tests are pretty much designed to exclude men because for a long time the U.S. Ideology was that able-bodied men shouldn't be receiving government policy or government benefit. It's designed for the elderly, the disabled, the women, and the children.
Before you go too much further, could you define means testing?
Yeah, so means tests are literally just ways of solving the free rider problem, quote unquote. So they're just stipulations, which if you don't qualify for that test, so to speak, you don't qualify for the policy. You don't get the benefit of the policy without passing that hurdle, I guess you could say. Our common welfare program is the EITC, the Earned Income Tax Credit, for example. And the means test associated with that is that you had to have already been working. So you can't qualify for this tax credit unless you're already working a job, but you're making below a certain income threshold. Now, my argument in my thesis is that inner city black men in particular, their situation is unjust because racist characterizations of black men in particular really have precluded them from getting those low-skilled service positions.
Which then kind of keeps them out from any means-based
A lot of means tests for welfare either have to have you working already, or you have to be a woman, or you have to be a single mother, you have to have kids, and most of the time, as we know, African-American populations suffer one of the lowest, if not the lowest, rates of marriage. So the woman tends to claim the child, not the father of the child. So that precludes them from receiving any sorts of benefits that go for people with children.
But isn't there a strong argument that there is a free rider issue and that means testings for social welfare programs can actually incentivize people to get a job or try to, you know, not rely so much on social welfare programs or social, you know, safety nets in order to actually lift themselves up? Isn't that the argument?
Well, I think the problem is that relies on the jobs being available to get. And mm-hmm. I think that's the point that Albert's making, mm-hmm. is that, for SNAP, for example, if you're an able-bodied adult without dependents, you can only qualify for a SNAP for 3 months in a 3-year span unless you're working at least 20 hours a week. So that, in an area where you can't get a job, can be a huge problem. And again, like, if you don't have children, you're not going to qualify for TANF. So things like that, I think you can make that argument, but the jobs have to be there for people to have them, or they're just going to be stuck.
Yeah, and I think another problem is, even if you do meet the means tests, these aren't the most financially literate people in the world, and it's not their fault. I mean, they're trying to live day to day, trying to survive month to month. They don't have time to learn about things like the earned income tax credit, which I actually did some research on that. Like, 1 in 5 of the people who are eligible for it don't even claim it, because they don't know they can claim it.
Mm-hmm. Or don't file taxes.
Or they don't file taxes, yeah. So, I mean, there's the odds are stacked against these people. And who's surprised when you know, they end up in a situation.
But I think what's a larger problem is, without access to capital, without a means of survival, more often than not, inner city black men are turning to what's called the underground economy, which is what we think of as drug trade, you know, illegal cab driving, perhaps committing robbery to steal goods to sell them, driving illegal packages across borders. And all of this behavior it's felonious behavior, so as a result, they tend to become to get incarcerated, which leads them to become felons, which almost entirely precludes them from ever getting a job in any sort of skilled position.
So it sounds so basically you're saying there's a vicious cycle that if you're a black man in a city, you're kind of screwed.
Yeah, definitely. And I think the welfare system as it's set up isn't designed to assist this specific cross section. And I think the result.
So what would be a better program though? So is there, other than means testing, which doesn't seem to be very effective, or if it is, I've not heard a very strong, throated beyond a rhetorical, support, any actual, data support. What else is there, though?
So
just saying, like, no means testing, or?
Yeah, absolutely. So like,
because isn't that the goal is to, lift people out of poverty? Or is that not the goal?
It just depends. So, I mean, that's a value judgment that policymakers and society have to make. I mean, for a long time, that was the judgment we made, that the goal was for the social safety net to tide you over until you could find a place in the job market. And I make a point of noting that behavior, you have to see it as what it is, and it's jobs. That is employment for them, and that is income, and that is how they survive.
And so then what happens if you take out the need for income then? So let's talk about the universal basic income idea then. So what happens if you implement a program like that in this case? How would that change behavior?
Yeah, so I'm a big proponent for the universal basic income. In my thesis, I'm arguing that this is, we could say, a better poverty solution or a better policy solution. And one reason is, by putting cash in hand for these populations, I argue, you first of all deter younger inner city black men from turning to the underground economy to begin with as a means for survival, which means you don't run, you reduce the risk in theory of them becoming felons and being completely excluded from the job market. This would allow them to do things like go back to school and actually get job training that they need. It might also allow them to take lower paying jobs to start. You could start off as a cashier at McDonald's making whatever the federal minimum wage is, right, $6.25 or $6.75, whatever it may be. But why would you do that if you could go sell bags of drugs for, $20 an hour?
So my question with the universal basic income is, specifically in your case, you're looking at issues of unemployment with African-American men in inner cities. Why would making a universal basic income that every American gets, like, how does the cost of that justify the effect? Like, why wouldn't you make something that's more geared towards, maybe we could just have a means-tested program for adult men?
Yeah, a targeted approach, so to speak. So my argument against that is that there are stigmas that come with welfare. We have this horrible characterization in this country of the welfare queen, quote-unquote,
right,
as this inner city, usually black in people's mind, mother who's living off of welfare and abusing the system. I argue that by having a targeted approach, and specifically a class targeted, because as we know in this country, class and race are completely intertwined.
Right.
We're only going to further alienate that group from the larger society by creating a stigma that they're, you know, lazy and living off of the system, living off of the hard-earned money of others, so to speak. By giving it to all people, you know, you do, you create much in the same way that we've created the culture of Medicare and of Social Security, the sense that it's an entitlement by virtue of being a 65-year-old citizen. Social Security is special because you pay into it, but Medicare, you don't. You can be homeless your whole life, and the minute you're 65, right, or 66, whatever the age is, we feel that you're entitled by virtue of being a citizen. We don't want a society that just because someone needs help because of their predicament they're in, that we shun them or we alienate them or we, you know, we shame them.
But I still have a question about how a universal basic income would alleviate racial job hiring practices.
So it wouldn't directly. So the reason being, so basically the racist characterization of African American men in particular as being lazy, as being not good workers, as being thieves, as being, you know, hot-headed, temperamental, you know, not fit for this low-skill service economy that exists around them. I would argue that policy can't change, you know, without a long period of time, it can't change the perception of hiring managers. But rather what we can do is put wealth in the hands of the inner city black community, and this wealth they have now, this purchasing power, will allow them to either save the wealth and begin investing, perhaps in mom and pop shops, like we used to see during, you know, the 1950s when African Americans were being, the 1940s and 50s when African Americans first moved to inner cities and they're actually being employed in manufacturing, and as a result, you know, there's a little bit of a flourishing in inner cities.
But isn't there a lot of the problems that they're associated with raising the minimum wage, for example, wouldn't some of the same problems apply to a universal basic income? I mean, if you give $12,000 to $15,000 a year to everybody, you're going to suffer from like inflation. You're going to have markets are going to change fundamentally, especially the housing markets. If everybody can afford housing, there's might be a housing shortage. You'll have to build
housing, which creates jobs, which leads to, I mean, you know what I mean? I mean, you may have to build houses in these inner city tracks, or
I
mean, that doesn't seem like a bad thing to me.
Sort,
if anything, that
sort
seems
of
like
a, there's sort
want.
Of a snowball effect here, and it strikes me as being very similar to a lot of the bad things associated with raising the minimum wage.
When we were talking about stigma and my question about why you wouldn't create a means-tested program that is targeted, I read a book about the EITC that was mentioning how that as a program seems to have a lot less stigma. Part of that is definitely because of the working component.
Yeah.
But part of that is also because it's administered through the IRS and through the tax system, in which case people don't know why you're at H&R Block. They don't know if you're getting an EITC or if you're just filing taxes like everyone else.
Yeah.
So what do you think the advantage of having the universal basic income over something like a negative income tax would be?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So, I mean, just a historical tidbit. Nixon looked at the universal basic income, and Milton Friedman, the old, you know, the libertarian, highly liberal economist, actually considered the universal basic income initially, and he deemed it not as good a program as the negative tax credit, and that's why he was a proponent for the EITC. That's why they created the EITC, and they pushed for it. So one problem with the EITC, I argue, is that it comes in one lump sum at the end of the year, and in order to achieve the sort of justice I'm talking about, we need a biweekly or a monthly sort of paycheck to come in, because people don't pay for your rent at one time at the end of the year. You pay for it, you know, monthly. You pay for your groceries.
Right.
And the other problem is, like I said, the universal basic income and the EITC, for that matter, respects your autonomy as a rational being, in that you might want to use that money for your rent, or you might want to use that money for a major medical surgery, perhaps, that or some sort of a family emergency or an investment. And one large lump sum EITC, I argue, would push you more towards those types of things, as opposed to spending it on groceries every week,
right,
or on, you know, clothing for your kids or for yourself.
If everybody has a guaranteed income, first of all, I think this is very utopian. This isn't something I see happening anytime soon. But if everybody had a universal basic income, people could decide not to work. They could just decide to go out and invest in their communities.
Be artists.
And is that a bad thing?
No, it's not at all.
I think it's a great thing. That's why I look at my paper through this argument of justice, and my approach to justice is, you know, known as the capabilities approach. It's sort of like
Martha Nussbaum.
Yep, Martha Nussbaum.
See, I'm name dropping
now. Yeah, Martha Nussbaum, Amartya Sen. So, you know, they look at basically, you know, how we look at justice should just be, you know, what humans as free deciding rational creatures would want to do, so long as they have a minimum assured to them. And, you know, if you want to take all your leisure time and go work a 9-to-5 still after, even though you can survive just off the income, you know, that's your prerogative. If you want to go become an artist and sell your art or just give it away for free, if you want to go become a community gardener, community activist, if you want to go become, you know, a congressman, whatever that's, but that's something that, as the system is set up now, I argue, a pretty fair amount of the population doesn't have the freedom to do that. You know, most people can't choose to become an artist, despite the fact that they might have the talent, they might have the love, the passion, the drive, but they're not afforded the ability. And I argue this is, you know, an injustice.
Welcome back. We are now turning to our final segment, which we call Spin This.
Woo!
Yeah, and this a little more lighthearted. What we do is I spin a wheel, and it randomly lands on a topic that one of our guests will have to speak about for roughly a minute and a half. And so quickly, our topics this week are essential benefits in high-risk pools. Does White House palace intrigue have a role in policy discussions? United Airlines, even though we've already talked about that a little bit. The filibuster and future of polarization and gun control. All right, so here we go.
Are we all going to talk
can we
about
clarify?
It?
Yeah,
what's
happening?
What do you mean?
So you're going to spin a wheel. You have a wheel app.
I got a wheel app.
Are we all ranting?
No, one person each.
Oh, we each get to spin?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
What if we don't know anything about what we spin?
Bullshit.
Okay, so that's going to be part of the fun of this segment.
We could pass the rant if
you're
right.
No, I think we should have to be.
I think you have to rant.
Oh, yeah.
All right, so who wants to go first?
I'll go first.
All right.
Oh, yeah, he rants.
It's hard to stop him ranting. Rant is his what he eats for breakfast.
Like, let's be honest, his whole podcast is a rant.
Okay, so yours is, does White House palace intrigue have any role in a policy discussion? Go.
White House palace intrigue? Oh, you mean how, like, members of the administration have been saying conflicting things?
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it does, because this administration does not have any message discipline. They can't keep their internal discussions or arguments or conflicts outside. They can't keep it in the White House. The Obama administration, you know, had this problem too. There was sort of the Biden camp, and there was the Clinton camp. There were the hawks and sort of the dubs, but it doesn't compare to what we have now. We have like Steve Bannon going up against Jared Kushner. We have what I call the adults, Mattis, McMaster, and
all the military guys.
We have them going up against all the crazies. It does, unfortunately, it has a place in policy discussion.
All right, excellent. Haley.
Okay. I know which one I want.
You have essential benefits in high-risk pools.
That's the one I wanted to talk about.
So exciting.
All right.
I am very excited.
Go.
Okay, so this is something that I've thought a lot about. I wish that our lawmakers took economics courses, because clearly they did not learn about social insurance and how the markets work.
Yay.
So, I think it's been interesting. It was interesting to see with the Republican proposal for the healthcare plan, some of the negotiations that were going on in terms of talking about stripping essential benefits, which arguably is the entire point of healthcare. And it's interesting to see things like maternity leave on the chopping block that only men are talking and voting about. And I think that we've already seen high-risk pools. We've been there. That was what the solution was before Obamacare. And I think it's interesting to me to see Republicans criticizing the Affordable Care Act, which is a very market-based healthcare plan in the first place. And so I think if you take away, they want, like, in order to have lower premiums, they're going to have to take away, like, all of those things that they've been talking about. But at that point, at the end of the day, you're going to have people who, you know, maybe could afford healthcare, but it's not going to cover anything that they would need healthcare for, which defeats the entire point. So, in essence, it is very stupid.
Excellent. Thank you. All right, Albert.
Well put.
So what are my three? So it's the remaining three.
Remaining three.
What? United Airlines filibusters a few. Jesus.
Not up my wheelhouse at all. I hope I can control it. No, I don't.
Filibusters and the future for polarization.
You have to make it up if you don't know.
Yeah, don't.
Go.
So I think this is something that definitely has to be done away with. The notion of, you know, just to be being able, one person to hold the entire political process hostage, to me is absolutely absurd, counterproductive, and it really drives people to, you know, further polarization to the edges of ideology. And what it really does is it deters our lawmakers from coalition building, from you know, giving a little to get a little in government. Instead, it allows them to, you know, to act in such a way that they did, where they overturn the rules after a filibuster happens to avoid filibusters, and then it becomes a simple, you know, nuclear option, which leaves more extreme things happening. I've lost. I don't know where I'm going with this.
Great.
So, don't know much about politics. I'm sorry, guys.
Leave it the old college try.
It's yeah, I did. You know? That was it. I should have handed it off to Adam.
Thanks for listening. Again, my name is Nathan Rupp.
I'm Albert Anaim. I was the guest speaker. Thank you guys for having me.
It's a pleasure. My name is Haley Dunn.
Adam Brooks, former militia member.
See you next week.
This show is edited by Nathan Rupp, produced by Haley Dunn, and music by Pelly Gunther.
Just to go back to the United Airlines issue, there was a, you guys read Duffelblog?
No, what's Duffelblog?
It's like, you know The Onion, right?
Yeah.
It's like The Onion, but for the military. there was an article
that's cute
that they made that said, the Pentagon contracts United Airlines to remove Assad from Syria.
terrible.
Oh, goodness.